Hey folks, welcome to Season 3. The following audio was recorded live via Spotify Live during the True Crime Podcast Festival in Dallas, Texas. As such, it's not quite the quality you're used to on this show. Don't worry though, for parts 2 and 3 of this series, we'll be back at our desks with all our equipment. For now, enjoy the introduction to Judge Crater as it happened live.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
Vanished is mixed in stereo surround and is best experienced using headphones. If you have a pair of headphones or earbuds, put them in now. This program is a theoretical account of the events that occurred on and after August the 16th, 1930. Although he was declared dead in absentia on June the 6th, 1939, there are many that believe the disappearance of Judge Joseph Force Crater remains unsolved. Vanished is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com.
August 25th, 1930, was the first day of the New York Supreme Court's fall term. But its newest judge didn't show up for court. Justice Joe Crater's lifelong ambition was to be a judge. By all accounts, he was ecstatic at his recent appointment to the bench by Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt. But his seat on the bench this day was inexplicably empty. In fact, no one had seen Justice Crater in 19 days when he cleaned out his office, cashed a couple checks for a fairly large sum of money, had dinner with a friend, then got into a taxi, never to be seen again. He left behind a frantic wife, a veritable harem of mistresses, and a brewing political scandal, but no solid evidence as to where he might have gone or what might have happened to him. Could Justice Crater have been the victim of the political machine, blackmail, or his own hubris? Was this the work of organized crime or a random act of violence? Or did he simply walk away of his own volition and start a new life in Chicago or California or Canada? Welcome to Vanished, Judge Crater. Jennifer Taylor. I am an attorney in Austin.
And my name is Chris Williamson. I am a podcast journalist and investigator out of Los Angeles and now in the Midwest in Kansas City.
If you've never listened to our show before, I just kind of want to give you a quick introduction about who we are and what we've done. We started with really just Amelia Earhart.
Yeah.
So I'll let you talk about Earhart because we started with Chasing Earhart. You started with Chasing Earhart.
Yeah, that's right. So we did Chasing Earhart for a long time. We did about 100 episodes of that show. So if you've ever heard it or heard of it, that's where I started my process with this whole thing. And about 6 months to 8 months before that show came to an end officially, I had this idea of doing the show in a different way and taking, really, it started with one question. And the question is, if you are all sitting in a jury box and you're hearing witnesses, you're hearing experts, you're hearing evidence in various theories on the case of Amelia Earhart, what's going to sell you? On that case, you've got every kind of piece of evidence you can imagine. You've got eyewitness testimony, you've got forensic evidence, you've got scientific evidence of all different types, and then you've got the official story of the U.S. government. You've also got 200 eyewitnesses in Saipan and the Marshall Islands that say that they interacted with Amelia Earhart, Fred Noonan, or their Lockheed Electra, or a combination of those three. So the idea was presented to Jen, hey, how could we make this feel real? How could we make this sound real? And how could we apply the rule of law to that case, to a case that was 82 years old at the time? now 85 years old. And that was really the birth of Vanished as a show. We did 16 episodes on Earhart, very deep dives, sometimes 3-4 hours long per episode. So really deep, robust dives. And we were never going to go beyond Earhart, but then we decided to do a season 2 of the show. And we kicked off season 2 with some other well-known cases you might have heard of, like Jack the Ripper. We covered John Wilkes Booth. We covered D.B. Cooper and the King of the Pirates, Henry Avery. So we sort of go all over history and cover all these different historical cold cases and test the evidence in a trial by jury that we actually act out as realistic as we can on the show. And we're getting ready to kick off season 3, and Judge Crater is our first case for season 3, and we'll sort of tease the rest of season 3 at the end of this conversation today.
So just a little bit of a roadmap. Today is, since we have a limited amount of time, typically our episodes are between 1 and 2 hours long, but we have a 30-minute window today to talk to you, so it's going to be kind of the 10,000-foot view of the Justice Crater case.
That's right.
In episode 2, we are going to break down Justice Crater's timeline, and we're going to talk about some of the political and economic and social factors that might have gone into, that might have a bearing on his disappearance. So we're going to do a deep dive into the case for episode 2. And then for episode 3, we have a guest joining us. I've relied heavily on Finding Judge Crater is the name of the book by Stephen Regal. So as you can see, I've tabbed it extensively. This is a fantastic book, and the author is going to be joining us for episode 3, and we're going to do a roundtable discussion, and we're going to talk theories. So we're going to talk about Steve's theory, and then we're going to talk about my favorite theory, and I'll chime in. Chris is well known for having some really wild theories, and so that will be Judge Crater. So to get us started, Chris, whenever I mention political machinery, what do you think of when you hear that phrase?
I think of really, but behind not only behind the scenes stuff, but forward facing stuff too. So you have everything really in the public eye, and then you've got something that's not in the public eye. And I feel like it's like a double sided, sort of a double edged sword. That's how I look at it.
Okay, in the 1920s and 1930s in New York City, political machine was almost synonymous with corruption. In the 1920s and 30s, the Democratic Party's political machine was an organization named Tammany Hall. That organization is going to be a major player in Judge Crater's case. He was a very prominent member of Tammany Hall. Think a predecessor to the DNC, except with some crime family vibes. Like they definitely were shady. And another big difference between modern day political party machinery versus Tammany Hall was the DNC, for example. Probably every Democratic politician is going to be a member of the DNC. Same with RNC. For Tammany Hall, it was probably about half of the Democratic politicians at the time had associations. And it was really important to have that endorsement from Tammany Hall to be successful. However, it wasn't necessary. FDR did not have, he had a very hot and cold relationship with Tammany Hall and was obviously quite successful. So their job was A, to endorse candidates, and B, to get out the vote. The way they got out the vote was they were divided into districts amongst particularly New York City. And the 19th Tammany Hall district is going to play a really important role in this story. Judge Crater was the president of the 19th district, and his good friend, Martin Healy, who will also play a prominent role in this story, was the district leader. So they were close friends, and they both had strong Tammany ties. So who was Justice Crater? At the time of his disappearance, he was newly appointed to the New York Supreme Court. For those of you who are not familiar with New York and the New York legal system, the New York Supreme Court is not the highest court. It is actually their trial court. Much like in some other jurisdictions, judges are elected, but also much like in other jurisdictions, even today, what will typically happen is a judge will retire towards the end of his term or in the middle of his term so that the governor can then appoint a replacement because it's not an election year. And then that person will have to run at the end of the term. But being an incumbent, they will have the advantage. So even though technically judges are elected, most of them are de facto appointed. And that's how it works in New York as well. The term of office for a New York Supreme Court judge is 14 years. Which was a surprise to me.
It's a long time.
Yes, I practice here in Texas. They're 6-year terms for appellate judges, and for trial judges, it's a 4-year term. So just to kind of give you a comparison, Justice Crater had been appointed in April of 1930. He would have to run for re-election the following following fall. He was a law professor. He was, by all accounts, a brilliant legal mind. He was also a bit of a party animal. And as the public would find out after he disappeared, a bit of a womanizer and was certainly into some shady nightlife hobbies.
To say the least.
For sure. Some other facts about him. He was married. His wife was named Stella. They had no children. And he was 41 years old at the time that he went missing. He was last seen on August the 6th, 1930. The court terms had a summer break. Up until August 25th, mm-hmm. he was on summer break. And so he and his wife were in Maine, in Belgrade Lakes, Maine, at a cabin that they owned where they were going to summer. He had a habit of kind of sneaking away every now and then. His wife knew about it. His wife never came with him, but he would go back into the city, maybe get some work done, maybe hang out with some friends, maybe hang out with some girlfriends. He went to Atlantic City on a weekend bender with some friends. I mean, he was a very active person. But he does go missing at the beginning of August. We know that he was seen on, so just kind of some highlights, like again, we're going to deep dive into this in episode two. On Saturday, August 2nd, he was in Maine with his wife. He had received a phone call saying that he needed to go back into the city to attend to some business. So we told her, okay, I have to go back to Manhattan. I promise I will be back by your birthday. Her birthday was August 9th. So he leaves and he is seen in the city on August 4th, 2 days before he disappears. He goes home. His maid sees him. They had a beautiful apartment on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. His maid sees him. He tells his maid, he says, no need to come back and keep cleaning. Please come back on the 7th because by then I will be back in Maine. That's my intention. Somebody else that saw him on the 4th, attorney William Klein and his girlfriend, mistress, lady friend, Sally Ritz.
All of the above.
We're having dinner and Crater runs into them at a restaurant on Monday. They invite him to join. They said that he seemed like he was in a great mood, that he was his normal, talkative, jovial self. And he told them, I intend to go back to Maine tomorrow, meaning the 5th. We don't really know much about his movements on the 5th, but we do have quite a bit of information about his movements on the 6th. So in the morning, he gets up, he goes to his chambers. He spends the morning going through his papers, shut up in his office. In addition to himself, he summoned two employees of his to come into the court, into his chambers with him. One of them was what I call a law clerk, but I think the actual term is law secretary, but it's not an administrative assistant. It's an attorney that works for the judge and will do research for them. And so it was an attorney by the name of Frederick Johnson. And then there was a second man there who his title was deputy clerk. I don't know for certain, but I think that the deputy clerk was actually an administrative assistant. So, and his name was Joseph Mara. So they were both there with him in the office that morning, and they reported that he was shuffling a lot of papers and he was shut up in his office and seemed to be cleaning out his office. Sometime that morning, Judge Crater gives Mara, his administrative assistant, two checks and asks him to go cash them. One was for $3,000, quite a bit of money in 1930, and the other was for $2,150. Again, quite a bit of money.
So that would be like almost $84,000 now. So just to give you like an idea of inflation, it's
yes,
a lot of money.
Lots a of bunch money. Of money. Mara does this. He goes, cashes the checks. He brings them back in big bills. $1,000 bills used to be a thing. Anyway, so he gives the cash to the judge. The judge pockets the money. And then around noon, he gets Mara's help again. He says, I need to take all of this stuff back to my apartment. Can you help me? And so he's got two briefcases and several file folders just filled with documents. And Mara accompanies him back to his apartment. He doesn't ever go back to chambers that day, but Frederick Johnson, who did work the full day and closed up the office, said that when he looked in the judge's chambers on his way out, the entire office had been cleaned out. No documents, papers, anything. And there were some documents in the trash, I think.
So this is really starting to feel like it's premeditated, obviously. He's making plans. He's telling his maid not to come back. He's getting some clerical stuff done at his office. He's having people cash checks for him. He's, these mysterious briefcases full of who knows what in there. Mm-hmm. And I feel like at this point, when I'm looking at this, he's making plans. So this is not a accidental disappearance or anything like that. This is pre-planned.
So they get back to his apartment. Mara helps him unload the stuff and he leaves. On Mara's way out, he will later tell investigators that the judge made an offhand comment that he was going up to Westchester Way, so upstate. Mara assumed that this meant that he was going to go swimming because there was a popular club there, like a lake house club that, mm-hmm. you know, politicians and that used to visit, like
rich
on
people.
Yeah. And so he just assumed that, oh, he's going to go swimming up in Westchester, but judge didn't actually say that. I'm going to Westchester. At 6 p.m., the judge was then seen purchasing a ticket at a box office for a Broadway show. We don't really know what time the show was supposed to start, but we're assuming that it started around 8:40. According to Steve's book, most shows at that time, they had specific show times that repeated, and 8:40 seems like the likely time when the show would have supposed to have started. But in any event, he never did go back and pick up that ticket, and he did not attend that show. And the reason why I mentioned the show time, though, is because from the box office, he went to dinner. And once again, he runs into the same couple that he had seen 2 days before. They're a bit surprised to see him, as he had told him that he was leaving and he's still here. They also reported that he seemed really reluctant to join them for dinner this time, that something was really off with him, that he seemed unusually down, depressed, and distracted. In any event, they have dinner and they stay until 9. And that's the only reason why I mentioned the showtime, because if the showtime was 8:40, it doesn't seem like he intended to go to the theater.
Right.
So then I'm not sure, what do you make of him buying the ticket?
Well, I'd heard that so the name of the show is called Dancing Partner, right? And I had heard that he had gotten the ticket from an associate, someone who sort of hooked him up with the ticket, like a VIP ticket, but he had apparently seen the show before and it was sort of a new show. So they weren't sure.
Yes, it was a brand new show. You're right.
How he could have seen it before.
Because when he went on his bender with his friends in Atlantic City, he was notoriously friends with a lot of showgirls. And they were watching a rehearsal. So he got to see a preview.
So he just stepped in and got to
see a preview. Yeah, so he got to see a preview of the show in Atlantic City. And so, yeah, so he goes to the box office to buy the ticket. And the guy who was selling him the ticket was one of his friends that had been in Atlantic City with him. And he actually later told investigators, he said, I was a little surprised that he wanted to see the show because we'd already seen it, but it wasn't, I didn't really think anything of it. So they stay at dinner until around 9. 9 p.m. on the 6th is the last time that he is seen. He and his two friends, they're leaving the restaurant and they're kind of going their separate ways. Klein and Ritz both tell investigators that they saw him get into a cab and go west on 45th Street, which is a one-way street, going towards what is now the Hudson River. And that's it. That is the last sighting anyone ever had of him. They did later they tried to find that cab driver and they were unable to. But as we'll talk about here in a bit, it was quite a bit of time before he was actually reported missing.
Yeah.
So some people read a lot into that they couldn't find a cab driver, so he must not have gotten into a cab. And weirdly, Klein would kind of change his story.
Yeah, they flip-flopped, right?
They flipped on that, and later they said, well, I didn't see him get into a cab. I saw him walking. And we'll talk about that when we talk theories, because in this book, Steve makes the argument that, no, their original story was that they got into a cab. It makes perfect sense that they weren't able to find a cab driver because it was a month or more before they actually had, started looking. But there are other, another book that I relied on in researching for this story, the author makes the argument that actually, no, they did not get into a cab, and why would Klein say that? And actually he was walking, and which, if that's what you think, then that might change your theory of what happened.
Yeah. What's your thought on that? Because why did they flip flop? I mean, I guess maybe for the same reasons that witnesses might flip flop in modern day.
Yeah. I don't read much
trials,
into it.
Right?
Don't read much into it.
Oh, he got in a cab. Well, actually, no, he walked. I mean, it's a very different scenario. It's a very different mode of transportation. It could have taken him very different places.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I think
it is
that's
interesting.
One of my
But
like,
I've seen witnesses change their stories on innocuous things so often that I personally don't read much into it, but I can see why somebody would. And just because I don't read much into it doesn't mean it's not important.
Right.
But that's just kind of my initial thought on that. So Judge Crater was, he had promised his wife he was returning to Maine by August 9th. August 9th comes and goes. And Stella, she's an interesting character in this story. She's more mad than anything. She was not particularly worried at first, because apparently it was not very uncommon for him to be caught up in work and to, you know, stay gone longer than yeah. he said. She was just more mad that, you know, he'd blown off her birthday. But as the days continued to go on and they had not heard anything, she starts to become worried. There's a lot of detail in the ensuing investigation. Like, there was a private investigation, and the police are officially brought in, and a lot of that we're going to have to save for episode 2, because there's a lot happening once people start to realize he is gone. But the highlights are Stella and their driver make a trip back down to Manhattan to see what they can find out. They go back to the apartment. Stella makes a bunch of frantic phone calls. One of those calls is to good friend Martin Healy, that I mentioned at the top of the show. She makes several phone calls to him. She's just making calls, and she's trying to figure out where he's at.
Has anybody seen him?
Yeah. Has anyone seen him? And at some point, she's reassured that, no, we saw him just the other day. Everything's fine. And so she goes back to Maine. We'll get into this more, but essentially what people are saying, there was a guy named Simon Rifkin who was an attorney who had worked with him and had known him, was kind of a friend. He was in touch with Stella during this time. Rifkin had called up the two men that were in his office who worked for him that day, was like, have you seen him? And they were like, oh yeah, everything's fine. And I think the feeling amongst his friends at this time was that he had gone on some kind of bender, that he was probably, you know, like tied up somewhere, and he had an election coming up that fall, and they were really worried. If we make too much of a big deal about this, this is going to hurt him politically. Let's just wait for him to come back. But he didn't come back. August 25th is the first day of the new term. As the junior judge, he was supposed to be the presiding judge. When he didn't show up, that is when people started to get very worried. Another of the judges on the bench calls Stella in Maine and says, hey, you know, where is your husband? He didn't show up. And that is when I say a private investigator. He was actually an NYPD detective, but he was acting as in a private capacity to try to help investigate this case without officially reporting it to the police, because again, they were still kind of worried about his reputation. They do a little bit of digging. They go back to the apartment. They're searching for things. Some of the things that they found, they noticed that he left behind his
deposit box, or they discovered that he had a safe deposit box and he'd emptied it.
Well, no, that was later. I'm trying to think, because they had discovered, I think it was like a, what was it? Those little business cards. He had some monogrammed items.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. And that was that's when bells went off for Stella, because these are things he always carried with him and he had left them behind.
That's right.
And then another thing that Stella thought was important is what we knew he was wearing when he went missing. It was a brown suit with green pinstripes, and it had a matching green vest, and he had worn that suit out, but the vest was still hanging up. And so these are just little things that, like, Stella as his wife was like, this concerns me, this is not like him, he always dressed to the nines, he would have worn the vest, why didn't he wear the vest? It was just little weird things. So they're digging around, they're not really finding much.
At what point do they then discover the briefcases and all that?
So that was later, because September 13th, which is more than a month after he's actually disappeared, two things happen. One, the public finds out, because the media breaks the story.
Changes the entirety of the case now, because now it's public.
Yes, now it's public.
Right.
And two, the NYPD officially gets involved. A report is officially made. I have read, and this is something I really want to get with Steve about, is I would like to know, because it's different depending on where you read it. I'm unclear on whether the news report prompted someone to be like, let's go ahead and report the missing, or if he was reported missing and then the media caught wind of it through that. Like, I'm not sure what came first.
Yeah,
and I think it matters. Mm-hmm. What came first? Because the idea that they didn't want to report him missing until they had no choice matters, I think.
Right.
But in any event, September 13th is the day.
That's the main day
that the investigation starts.
Right.
The safety deposit box comes later, because this was the grand jury's investigation. Weirdly, a grand jury is convened to investigate this case. We don't have any evidence that a crime has occurred. A grand jury is typically convened to investigate whether or not you would like to bring an indictment against, you know, and pursue criminal charges against an individual. It's not typical to use a grand jury in this way. But that is what was done. District Attorney Thomas Crane, he had convened the grand jury and was over this investigation. He was a Tammany Hall member, and that may be important.
Yeah.
And he was highly criticized. He was not a well-liked DA. He was initially charged with being corrupt after an investigation that had nothing to do with this, but turns out he was really just incompetent. The grand jury, they interviewed several witnesses. They yeah. interviewed friends. They tried to interview Stella. Stella was not cooperative with the investigation.
Which is interesting, I think, because yeah. she was the one that was sort of, all the alarms went off with her, and she was making a lot of noise
yeah,
about
she was,
stuff, and then
she
her
was,
not being cooperative.
Exactly. She was legitimately worried, I think,
right.
about her husband, but she also did not want it. She had no interest in cooperating with the official investigation.
So that's an interesting aspect of the whole thing.
Right.
Because you're either all in or you're not.
I think she, like all of his friends, was worried about him politically. Like, I think that, you know, yeah. she was a politician's wife. She was well aware of what the rules were when
yeah.
something like that happened. But the safety deposit box was found out by Crane's investigation. So they're the ones, they did find out that he had a safety deposit box. They went and forced it open. It was a big deal. The media was there and there was nothing in it. So he had emptied that out, whatever was in there.
And the money and the checks and all that. So yeah, it's interesting.
Well, we don't know what was in the safety deposit box.
So
we have no idea what may have been in there.
Could have been anything in there.
Could have been anything. We just
right.
know there wasn't anything.
When they found it.
Exactly.
It had been emptied. Right.
A couple of highlights as the investigation wears on. The media runs wild with this because now mistresses are starting to come out of the woodworks. Which
is that familiar at all? Mistresses coming out of the woodworks?
Yeah. Yeah. So one of them was a woman named Connie Marcus, who was a long-term mistress. 7 years they had been together. She legitimately thought that one day they were going to get married and he was like paying her rent. But he had a lot of mistresses on the sides that are kind of coming out. And so we will dive into, like, we'll do a deep dive. There was a letter that the New York World received from, it was an anonymous letter, but from someone claiming to be a mistress. And we'll deep dive into that. I just kind of want to tease it a little bit. It ended
yeah.
up really not going anywhere, but somebody named Lorraine Fay had hired an attorney and had told that attorney that she wanted to pursue a breach of promise to marry legal action, which was apparently a thing. And then she claimed in her letter to the press that, you know, well, Judge Crater paid me $5,000 and made it all go away. But later they tracked down the attorney, and the attorney, you know, was like, yes, this happened, but I'd actually take the case. Like, I told her to come forward with whatever documents she had and we would go, you know, we would pursue the case, and then she just ghosted. And so it seems like there were some half truths in the letter. I think there was a lot of people trying to take advantage of a sensational case. So there's a lot of salacious, you know, tabloid stuff going on. And a lot of people thought that whatever happened to him had something to do with his wild partying lifestyle, or maybe someone was blackmailing him, or there's a lot of theories.
Or maybe he just walked away from his life.
Maybe he ran away with one of these ladies,
or just on his own to start a new life somewhere.
Yeah.
Which is interesting in and of itself, because of sort of the steps you were seeing him take.
Mm-hmm.
Preliminary steps in his, you know, getting his affairs in order.
But he was also seen to be upset and agitated and nervous.
So maybe he was forced to walk away from his
life.
I'm just going to start spitting theories out as we go here. Yeah.
So something else to mention in our 10,000-foot view of the case is the items that Stella found. It was January of 1931. The case had really kind of wound down. I want to say it was after the election when the grand jury came out with their findings, and their findings were basically, we have no idea what happened.
I have the quote here. The evidence is insufficient to warrant any expression of opinion as to whether Crater is alive or dead, or as to whether he is absented himself voluntarily, or is the sufferer from disease in the nature of amnesia, or is the victim of a crime. So they basically make the determination they have no idea what happened.
But what's interesting about that is, even though there was a lot of investigation the grand jury had done, there was a lot of information they weren't able to get and did not know. For example, we know that he had received a phone call on Saturday before he disappeared while in Maine, calling him back to New York. Like, we know that the grand jury did not have access to that information. And so there are things like that that we'll get into as we discuss this case further, that as thorough as that grand jury investigation was, they did not have nearly the information we have now.
Yeah.
One important thing I want to mention, in January, Stella comes back. The purported reason she gives, She says, I've run out of money. She needs money from her husband's estate. So she comes back. She'd been staying in Maine this entire time. When she gets there, she makes a discovery. She opens up one of the drawers in her bedroom and finds...
She finds checks, stocks, bonds, and a note from the judge in a dresser drawer, which had been empty when searched earlier by police.
Yeah, so I have a more detailed list. It was $6,690 in cash, Crater's will, which is super convenient because she really, you know, she needed a probate
that
will. Four life insurance policies totaling $30,000, which is a huge amount of money at that time. Several bank books, the lease for a residence in Harlem, the deed to the cabin in Maine, an envelope containing stocks in public companies, including 10 shares of Martin Healy's company, which we still haven't even talked about how he's possibly related. We'll get there. Checks, one of them written to himself and dated August 4th. Mm-hmm. It was a check for $500 that had already been endorsed but had not been deposited. And then the letter.
Yeah.
So the letter was handwritten and it was addressed to Stella and it was marked confidential. And it was basically like a list of, it was an accounting of all of his stuff. And it was, here are all of the people that owe me money. And at the end it said, you know, it either said, I'm very weary or I'm very sorry. The handwriting is bad. Everyone argues over what it says. The fun part about that is she calls police. Oh, I've made a discovery. And they get there and there's a detective with them who had, you know, they had searched the apartment multiple times and they put on this big show of like, he brings the detective in and they says, what was in this drawer? And you searched it. And he said, well, there was a hand fan and there was this, this, and this. And he names off like five things and he opens the drawer and all five things are in there. And they do this with all the drawers, demonstrating that like he knew, he searched that place thoroughly and he knew it was in all those drawers. The implication being they're accusing her of finding it.
Yeah.
And when in fact they believe that she had been holding on to this. I mean, that's reasonable to think. She had been at that apartment. Mm-hmm. She had come down, remember, before he was officially reported missing. And
so
it's quite likely.
Yeah.
It's very, very likely, I think, that she had found all of these documents, kept them to herself, never told anyone about them during the investigation. And when it came time for her to need to probate the will, mm-hmm. all of a sudden she has to... She can't say I've had this the whole time.
Yeah.
Because how do you explain that?
Right.
She makes up this story about how she just found them. She stuck to her guns, though. It didn't matter how, you know, like there was, it was pretty bad. They would be like, look, we know you didn't just find this. And she was very adamant, like, nope, she just would not change her story.
Yeah.
So there's that. But no solid leads really ever came of any of these investigations. As you've heard, the grand jury had no idea what had happened. There were really no good leads. There were sightings of him coming in from all over the world.
Sounds familiar.
Countries all, you know, Canada, California, just everywhere. They did their best to follow up with the ones they thought were credible, but they found absolutely nothing. Like the trail just absolutely went cold and that's it. Like we don't know what happened to him. Martin Healy, I will leave all of that for our next episode, but suffice it to say he was under investigation. He was working in city government. And he was under investigation at the time of the disappearance for receiving large sums of money. This one in particular was a man named George Ewald. He had been appointed as a magistrate judge by the mayor and at around that exact same time had given a large sum of money to Martin Healy, who was known to have a lot of influence with the mayor. And so he and Ewald were both under investigation for corruption, buying judge positions. And on the day that Justice Crater disappeared, Healy had been fired from his city job. And Crater was a person of interest in this investigation, not because of any alleged wrongdoing that we know of, mm-hmm. but because he knew Healy well, and because they believed that he was a witness that had a lot of information. And there was actually a subpoena that was issued before anyone knew that he had gone missing to come testify before the grand jury in that investigation. So we will dive really deep into that investigation probably when we record episode two.
Yes.
Because it's very relevant, I think, just simply because of timing.
And it's just the tip of the iceberg. This is so Judge Crater is just a sort of a tease for what's coming for season three. We're in pre-production right now on season three. I know we've been sort of keeping people waiting. We've had a lot of stuff going on. Season three is going to be a big one. We have some real big marquee cases. So Judge Crater is one of the smaller cases that people really don't know a whole lot about. There's also another case we're going to be covering about Amy Johnson, who was another aviator who sort of disappeared in the wake of Amelia Earhart's disappearance and was actually really close friends with Earhart, and ironically disappeared to the day 2 years that Earhart was declared dead in absentia, which is really interesting in and of itself. And then also in season three, we're going to start covering some really big cases, you know, cases you know, Jesse James, Jimmy Hoffa, Zodiac, Alcatraz, and then of course Judge Crater as well. So season three is really stacked. We're going to be starting recording sometime and hopefully release around Halloween like we did with Jack the Ripper in season two, and we'll keep going until season three is wrapped a little more aggressively this time around, and we're just excited to get into it. So this is just the tip of the iceberg for season three. So we wanted to say thanks to everybody for coming out and just sort of
and I just saw the time we went way over, so
yeah, we did go over about a little bit.
So thank you guys for sticking with us. It was way longer than 30 minutes. I think we got lucky in that no one took the time slot after us, so
right,
we got to be a little bit more stingy with our time. But even with that was still very much the high points, and we are certainly known for being super chatty and having long episodes, and so I'm really looking forward to recording our deep dive on Crater's timeline and on what happened, and then really excited to dig into the rest of our cases. So thank you all for coming. I had a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for being here. Thanks for watching. We appreciate it. It was really fun. Thank you.
What you just heard is only the beginning, I promise you. I gotta admit, I didn't think this Judge Crater thing would be that interesting, but Jen has a knack for introducing me to cases that capture my interest as soon as I start looking into them. After much discussion, Season 3 has arrived, and it feels great to be back. In Episode 2 of our Crater series, we begin to explore theories, ideas, and maybe a conspiracy or two regarding the judge's mysterious vanishing. Something tells me that this will be a sleeper case for us. People will be talking about what comes next for a long time. See you soon. This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/vanishedpod. On Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, search the handle @vanishedpod. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast player to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your co-hosts for Vanished are Jennifer Taylor and Chris Williamson. The show is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by me, Chris Williamson. The opening theme for our Judge Crater series is Lost by Tony Ann. Additional music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Vanished are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are intended here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Vanished is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films, Inc., and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films. All rights reserved. Vanished is a Madhouse Films production. Copyright 2022. All rights reserved.